At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
I'm Matt Jolly, and this is History Worth Saving, coming to you from the Red Barn at Fairchance Farm in Georgia, where great American stories grow strong. Welcome to the third season. Please, if you would, sign up for the newsletter at historyworthsaving.com. I'd love to stay in touch. And remember, if you like the show, tell your friends. If you don't, well, bless your heart. Thanks for listening. Now, here's the show. On this episode of the History Worth Saving podcast, we're exploring some of the greatest American mysteries of all time. The Bermuda Triangle, Flight 19, Amelia Earhart's disappearance, even Bigfoot. And we're doing it with a man who I respect and find incredibly fascinating. He takes these mysteries, these unknowns, and he researches them to the nth degree, and then explains it all very logically in a fashion that each and every one of us can understand. I'm talking about the author, Ian Quasar, and he joins us now from out on the West Coast to explain away on some of these great American mysteries. Ian, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I first came across you with your book, Into the Bermuda Triangle, and the connection not far from here, the Okefenokee Swamp, is mentioned in several of your books. Specifically, They Flew Into Oblivion, talking about the disappearance of Flight 19. So many mysteries. How do you start to research a project like this yourself? Because you're so detail-oriented. I can't imagine. I mean, there's so many things that have gone awry in the Bermuda Triangle. Where do you start?
I got a negative review once because I was too detailed.
But, you know, in this kind of work, that ought to be like on your mantle, I would assume.
I hope so, yeah, because it's these are all treated like Saturday afternoon pulp, and I think that's basically why I was motivated to look further into all of them, because, you know, they're these world-famous mysteries, but they're never really investigated. They're just regurgitated. And so that's really what motivated me. I like to look into mystery, but with the chance of solving it, not just, you know, repeating it and wallowing in it and getting my own chill and thrill, but actually trying to crack it.
And I think
I would say that's
successful.
What motivated me.
Right. Well, and you start the research out, I mean, by event, or how does that, walk me through your mindset on something like this?
Well, when I first started with the triangle, it would be the events, all the missing ships and planes, and so I, as a young man, started reading the books, you know, 1990, and so the oldest book, the most recent book, I should say, at that time was probably 13 years old. And the authors disagreed if it was true or not. And so I thought if it was, the phenomenon would still be going on. So I actually went to the National Transportation Safety Board and got data readouts for missing aircraft. Went to the Coast Guard about boats. And massive amount of disappearances in the 1980s when no books were written, no documentaries, nothing like that. And so I realized the phenomenon was still going on. And I just, that's how I approach, you know, all these topics, not just to document mystery, but to do so in steps leading toward a solution or helping to lead toward a solution. I would have to say that would be, so the event would, you know, inspire me. So in the triangle, you have something like Flight 19, five Avengers that vanish. Obviously, that's one of the most significant aviation mysteries in history, regardless if it was in the triangle or not. So I looked into that in detail and got all these pictures, talked to anybody who was alive still. And that is what inspired They Flew Into Oblivion. And I was, you know, able to uncover some botch-ups in the search and a lot of evidence pointing to five Avengers going down in a federal refuge in southern Georgia. And I think that's why that remains a very popular book, because of all the evidence and then, of course, the controversy that they went down on land and not at sea, and it wasn't in the triangle anymore.
Well, and if I recall, and I don't want to give the book away, but one of the most fascinating things that I love that you consider factual, I assume, maybe I just put words in your mouth, but you're not afraid of the great beyond and the spiritual aspect of some of this. If I recall, there was a dream that was had by one of the widows that I believe is mentioned in your book. Is it not?
Flight 19, well, only one was married, so she had some kind of premonition, yeah, and she was trying to call the base. Well, it's all, you know, I'm going to have to consider all evidence, all clues. So if someone has a dream, a premonition, and they're calling the base trying to get to their husband and find out that he's on the flight in which he vanishes, that, you know, legitimately has to be mentioned. It doesn't really go anywhere in investigation, but, you know, it has to be mentioned.
That particular book, They Flew Into Oblivion, which is available, by the way, really wherever books are sold, Amazon included, that to me was so eloquently explained, and I know that it has to just be part and parcel from all of your work, the way it's written. I think people will find this really, really surprising when they dive into this. Something that I didn't even realize that you had on your radar was Bigfoot. Can you share just a little bit about that?
I know you've been recasting Bigfoot.
Yeah, let's talk about that just a little bit.
The book for which I am vilified.
Well, even better then. So
I'm hated. Well, because I didn't dismiss Bigfoot, but I didn't endorse the popular culture image that came from the Bigfooters, the original Bigfooters, like you know, Rene DeHinden and John Green and all these. You know, Peter Byrne, all these great old guys that were out there kind of setting the narrative, or the Patterson film. But there is overwhelming evidence for a Native American anthropoid, not one from the old world, as they would say, but one that came up from South America and is, you know, many stories down there of an actual anthropoid, not a monkey, but the ape, let's say ape version of a monkey. And it's always been amazing that, you know, with all the monkey species in South America and Central America, no one officially ever encountered an anthropoid, an ape of the New World, a Platyrrhinian ape. But there was a lot of reports going back even to Pedro de Leon about this hairy wild man that lived out in the forest. And I followed all these historic references and compared them to the Indian artwork all along the north Pacific Northwest, and they are describing features of South American primates, and they are describing other attributes that South American tribes were describing as well. And so I followed that through, and that's why the book is called Recasting Bigfoot, that there was in fact an anthropoid, and maybe it's still around, but it's very unlikely. It's from the old world.
I think one of the great things about these types of mysteries is how it sort of permeates into the Americana culture, if you will, and what is real and what is not real is not as important as the chase. How does your work fit into all of that?
Well, I like the chase, but sometimes my conclusions are not what those devotees to the subject matter like, as in the case of Bigfoot. But the chase, it uncovers the truth. I wanted to see if this stuff was really true. I grew up as a kid, you know, in the 70s, watching these documentaries, Sunshine Classic, all those, and, you know, sit there goggle-eyed and ooh and ah at the whole prospect of UFOs and Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster and all that. But the chase to uncover the kernel of truth, as you put it, it's far more interesting because it does lead you to other revelations, to true mystery in some cases. In some cases, you know, you have to explode the mystery. And so I find it all very fascinating. It's unfortunate that the topics are somewhat lightly considered. Hopefully my approach is not considered that way. But, you know, many times the, you know, well, something like Bigfoot or UFOs is going to be very, it's going to be recounted with smirks by newsmen and so forth. But that's not my approach to confirming and reconfirming popular legend, but to looking behind the narrative and seeing what really started all this and where does one truly logically follow this, not simply follow all the marketing, what's become popular with each chapter as something new is added. like with big, you know, UFOs, then, you know, abductions became vogue in the 60s and 70s and all this stuff. And we're wandering down all these side streets and forgetting how we even got there. So I kind of go back to the beginning and retrace and see where the actual facts lead.
I'm curious, and I'm sure you've thought about this several times, but is there something in our culture that we assume as fact, concretely, that you have mused about and maybe taken apart and dissected in this manner and discovered something else?
Oh, yes. UFOs.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that just a little bit.
The extent that UFOs are actually our own spycraft, our own secret inventions, our own testing of German inventions is remarkable. And only buried within all of this, there are reports of something that's hard to explain, and that would be an oval disc, which was reported in the 1920s by reliable authors. One got published in 1929, which I quote in some of my work. And so the phenomenon is there of an ovoid flitting through the atmosphere, sometimes quite huge. But after World War II, when the glut comes upon us, the flaps, so much is our own testing, so much of the great second flap that started in 1965 that really created the modern image of UFOs, the light hovering over a rural road and people looking, gaping up through their windshield and power outages, the abduction stuff, all of that, anything that we have today really comes from 1965 to 67, not 1947 to 52, the first great flap. And it is very clear from researching and stuff that's been released kind of under the table that those were our own spy devices. One, you can put a name on it, it's Lightcraft. And they were used to test our nuclear missile facilities, and that's when you used to hear all these reports in the 60s and 70s of all these UFOs descending. And these things put out such electromagnetic energy that they could erase the targeting tapes or reset the digital ones. And I must assume that's why they were being used, to see if they could be used as a weapon.
And then how do you explain away the abduction piece of that? Because that seems to be really intrusive on a variety of matters, Ian.
Well, hopefully it's not taking experimentation to a psychological level, but some of these, it's hard to explain. On my website, actually, not in a book, but on my website, I have a couple of really detailed cases on the Betty and Barney Hill case and why it's so hard to figure out. And then, of course, Pascagoula in 1973, and I have hopes it's not psychological experimenting, but there's a lot of contradictory stuff with that. And then, of course, the people feel quite privileged eventually, and they start trying to capitalize on it, and they just muddy the original truth, as in the Betty and Barney Hill case or the Pascagoula abduction, which rate as the two highest ones there are on the list for abductions. They set the entire vogue.
And I guess that's what I was, you know, that falls back to the original question. At what point does something we believe in so concretely, whether it is this particular instance or anything for that matter, become so entrenched without really even investigating it? So that's fascinating stuff right there.
Big-headed gray little aliens. That's one of the most false images you can imagine. That can be traced to the moment it was born. And it is something so after the fact and so heavily based on science fiction of the 1950s. And we take that for fact. Now, the alien motif is everywhere, you know, the little almond eyes and all that stuff.
And where did that come from?
Well, it starts with the Betty and Barney Hill case. That's under hypnosis. That's what Barney said one looked like, and it just simply grew more egregious afterward. And it's contradictory to what Betty's dreams, where she said they wore Air Force-type uniforms and had big noses like Jimmy Durante. And so what's being done here between the two? One is hypnosis. The other one is dream recall. It's just with time and the growing popularity of it, the big head grew bigger and rounder, and the eyes grew bigger. And it's heavily based on science fiction, like Invasion of the Saucer Men, it's just too much like that to ignore. You look at all the early UFO newsletters that were going along, and like APRO and NICAP, none of this description of little aliens is in there. This is something purely traceable, easily traceable to sci-fi, and then the Betty and Barney Hill.
I'm guessing that
sci-fi, of course, because that was the view of the time. Sure. They have to be so much smarter than us, so they've got bigger heads because they have to have bigger brains.
Right. And I'm assuming you're not a frequent guest at some of these sci-fi conventions, but
I've never been.
I see. Yes. I think there's a problem with that. I mean, you're sort of the only adult in the room, standing there looking around, going, "Well, hey, look, what about this?" But Ian, talk to me about your career as an American writer, as an author, because you sort of touched on this. You said, you know, sort of the low looks from the journalist and the squints from one eye and this kind of stuff. But what's kept you going on this subject matter?
Oh, it hasn't been money. I don't think I've ever really made anything off the books. I like to share. You know, I was really inspired when I was young, so I realized I had the ability to seriously investigate topics that are not investigated at all. And I've come up with a lot of very interesting information, even if it does contradict the popular folklore. And I like to share it. I share it on my website, which is growing to 500 pages. I share it in the books, which, of course, is more detailed. Except for certain aspects, you know, something that cannot be done in a book, I will do on my website with a lot of video or pictures. I did that with one crime case and was even invited to share freely with two jurisdictions that were investigating, so that I had actually detectives in the district attorney's office, special DNA section for homicide, who would process my persons of interest and get back to me, and the lead detective in Sacramento who would process. And you'd hear back. When they know you, you'd hear back. If you turn someone into a jurisdiction and they don't know you, you'll never know what comes of it. Mm. But if they know you, they'll tell you that he's been ruled out for this and that reason, and then you're at ease over it. But the other ones, I've been in one circumstance where someone came to me over a totally different case, and I saw how he fit a child abduction and murder case, which I don't look into because I don't like that kind of stuff. But so I tried to turn the guy into a couple of jurisdictions, and it was very difficult just to give a tip. So I kind of stay out of doing stuff like that.
True crime is not going to be the next popular book for you, I guess. Although you have written on Jack the Ripper, if I remember right.
I have, yes.
Yeah.
Jack the Ripper, when you start Cold Case, Jack the Ripper's the first one you have to look into. That would be Scarlet Autumn. But so there's I divide my, you know, journalistic approach to books and to the Questor Files, my website, if it's something that really cannot work in a book, where it needs lots of pictures, lots of video, and stuff that people can surf through for free.
Well, and we're going to link to your website there, obviously, in this show story, and we'll make that available. But for the folks listening on the podcast, give them your website one time, Ian, if you don't mind, just so they can follow along here.
www.thequestorfiles.com.
And on there, you can find all of this fascinating information that he's talking about. But help him out and buy some books, because as you can imagine, being the American expert on so many of our fascinating mysteries simply does not pay well. Ian, I think
that, no, it doesn't.
You know, I think everybody thinks, you know, that you're just rolling in it. You've of course frequented so many radio shows, and I'm imagining documentaries and whatnot that we've seen you on. And I think that's when I first came across you, was on a documentary on the History Channel. How has the dawn of the internet, I mean, now we're really into it with YouTube and all of this stuff, how has that shaped what you do?
Well, for investigation, it's helped with documents and historical documents going online. I'm quite involved right now in trying to dissect the kind of like the American Whitechapel murders in San Francisco. There were the gay murders over the 1970s when over 30 guys were murdered in rather bizarre and disgusting circumstances, kind of like Jack the Ripper's victims. And so going back to uncover who these were and then dissect, is there a serial killer involved here? He's often called the Doodler. People probably don't even know about the case. It's been so buried in from the 1970s on. But for online research, it never would have seen the light of day if it had not been for a couple of guys about 10 years ago beginning to write about this. And then about 6 years ago, I began to write about him, but I realized there is another one involved that I call Jack the Knife. And I'm trying to determine now through all these records of guys who were murdered when and where, and just see how many serials were involved. And it's impossible without the internet. I have to put little pegs in Google Earth just to find out, you know, keep my head straight where everybody was and where they were killed and where the bars were, where someone was last seen.
Wow.
Because we're talking, again, very much Whitechapel type of murders, in an alley, by a bar, in a parking lot, strangled, mutilated in Sado, in a deep basement, back at the flat, in a park.
Yeah, the kind of places right out of the movie that you don't want to be. On a dark and stormy night. Let's talk about a lady for just a little bit. Then Came the Dawn, Then and Now, your latest work about none other than Amelia Earhart. What have you learned in this? Because as an aviation guy, I find this subject to be one of the ones that seems to, every time it comes up, you just kind of look at it, like you said, down your nose a little bit and go, well, let's see how much this stinks. But when I saw that you had ventured into this, I thought, now here's a book I've got to read. Talk to me about Then Came the Dawn.
Well, I drug my heels over it for 10 years because biography is not my thing. And it's not a biography of her. Of course, the first part of the book is about her life and so forth. It's just very brief. You know, it's not an in-depth, but it has to be put in perspective, or, you know, the entire investigation of her disappearance and then and now. The search is pointless without knowing a bit about her. But I'm surprised the extent that she's negatively covered today. You know, because those who start criticizing her say, well, she wasn't the foremost woman pilot in the world. And they go from there, and they don't seem to realize that she was not the best pilot. She was a good pilot, very good pilot by the time she vanished, but no, she didn't begin as the best pilot. She was the product of a lot of publicity, but she developed into a very good pilot. But her fame was far beyond piloting skill. She was a charismatic, charming, basically motivational speaker and writer. And that's something that I think is fairly forgotten today, because people keep trying to judge her fame based on piloting skills, which was never the standard of her fame, even in her lifetime. So she was more of the center of a personality cult, and she motivated people to follow their dreams, and she was determined to fly around the world. And she finally set off to do so, and managed it very well with Fred Noonan as the navigator and back. She wasn't a great navigator. I think ultimately she knew she would have to have a navigator aboard. So she flies around the world, and coming to the most dangerous leg of it, from Le New Guinea to Howland Island, that's, as everybody knows, that's when she vanished. And the evidence, you know, yes, she was a very haphazard planner. She was very happy-go-lucky, as her first independent biographer, Colonel Briand, put it. She was happy-go-lucky in her preparations. Well, she was a bit haphazard, and so things happened, a number of things outside of her control. I think we can fairly accept that her receiving antenna had blown off on takeoff at Le New Guinea. She could not receive anything from the Itasca. She thought that 7.5 megahertz did work on her homing antenna, her homing device, when it did not. And so she had agreed with the Itasca to receive voice on 3105 kilocycles, and then the homing signals on 7.5 megacycles. And she could not receive on either due to the antenna going down, and then the fact that even though it was stenciled on her her receiver, she could not receive on that channel. So she was incapable of finding Howland Island. She wasn't getting any response from them because, you know, she couldn't hear them on her receiver. And I think at the end that she did turn off and go back to the Gilbert Islands, which was their plan. It was spoken only, you know, off and on that she would go back to the Gilberts, and that's, you know, how kind of bad she was at planning. Mm. But I don't believe in the crash and sink. There's nothing to it. It's just filling in, you know, looking at an empty ocean and saying, well, her last radio message was received signal strength 5, which is good, very good. But there's more signal strengths above that, and she, you know, she would have gone back to the Gilberts, I think. And so I think there is a chance that some of the legend, from what I picked up on the evidence I could find back then, which was the most important, that she could make a reef and could have even drifted to the Marshall Islands, where she was picked up perhaps a couple of months later. And they didn't know who she was then in the Marshall Islands by that time. The Japanese did know who she was while she was searching. This idea that a Japanese naval vessel would have picked her up right away and taken her to the Marshall Islands, and they didn't know who she was, or they would have shot her, that's all rubbish. They would have known exactly who she was. They were asked to search. But if she's drifting for a couple of months or on an island and then drifts off and is picked up by a fishing vessel near the Marshall Islands, that's a different thing. Japan was at war with China at that time. The locals in the Marshall Islands would not have really known who she was. She would have been transshipped by the companies, not by the military. And so you get a lot of room for error here. And the earliest, the most reliable reports that Fred Gerner, the CBS journalist, could pick up in the 1960s on Saipan was that a man and woman looked very sick and weather-beaten. They looked very... you know, as though they'd been going through this for months. Mm. And so ultimately she could have died on them eventually at Saipan, and they didn't know what to do. Here they had someone very famous. They might have recognized her, and then she dies, which is the report from the people at the hotel, that this American woman pilot died in a pool of her own blood in bed. Mm. So from some kind of typhus, maybe scrub typhus, I don't know. Or the local police chief was a real vicious guy. He was known to beat people and thought they were spies. And again, this is locals. That's the thing that people discover, and then came the dawn, is that the legend that the Japanese military and administration was involved has no basis in fact. These were islands that were administered by the South Seas colonial government, which Japan set up in Koror. And everything going on in these islands would go through Koror to the Minister of Colonial Affairs in Tokyo. Nothing went straight to Tokyo from these islands. And there was very minimal military liaison at the time. They were all over in China. They had just invaded China. And so if, from what we now know of the political circumstances and how those islands were managed, it would have been the powerful South Seas trading companies that were involved. And then locals, so the Saipanese police under Jesus de Leon Guerrero. And now they could have been very ignorant as to who she was.
And that seems to be the course of your research there. While you were doing that, did you come across anything that was just adamant that this was, in fact, Amelia Earhart? I mean, because I know on both sides of the research you often find a really strong positive. Was it a family member who said, oh, yes, my grandfather had her here in the hotel, or however that worked? Did you come across a few of those or even one?
I came across I compared the earliest ones in the book that Gerner and then Joe Gervais was actually first. He started talking to the Saipanese on Guam a month before Gerner got there. Unfortunately, Gervais would come up with that she's alive and well and living in New Jersey. He's the sponsor of that theory. But early on, he did a lot of real in situ research in the area, and then Gerner did as well. So if you take the earliest information, you see how some things do fall in place. Right away in the beginning is that this woman pilot is very thin, seems to be sick, and that she lasts only a week.
Mm.
And that the native detectives on Saipan are all around the case, not the Japanese. As journalists returned, the whole idea of Amelia Earhart being executed by the Japanese and being the first victim of World War II becomes popular. The information is certainly getting to Saipan as well, and the stories become more elaborate. The Japanese are all over the incident. She lasts for months. The same people who told Gervais early on a week are then telling Fred Gerner a year later that, oh, this she lasted for years, for, you know, for months at any rate, and then didn't die, was taken off to Japan somewhere. And it becomes quite unbelievable.
Right. But the earliest the legend stories, is born at that point, right?
Yeah.
Right.
But the earliest indications are that she did get to the Marshall Islands, and then from there, apparently she was taken to Saipan, where probably she did die, and they didn't know what to do, because now it was a couple months later.
Fascinating stuff. Then came the dawn. It's the latest out by our guest today, Ian Quasar. Ian, thank you for coming on. I there's so many questions that I'm sure everyone is going to have after hearing this. They can follow you there at your website, which will be quick linked into the show story. They can buy your books. And I'm just curious, do you give lectures?
No, I have no public speaking capabilities.
This is it, right?
This is it.
American and mystery solver. Ian Quasar, I hope that people understand the debt that our country owes to you after just painstakingly researching all of this stuff and putting it in real context, not pulp, as you said earlier on in the show. Thank you for what you're doing, Ian. It's great work.
Well, thank you very much.
And we'll talk soon. Ian Quasar.
I should use that as an endorsement.
There you go. Well, it is. It's great work. And it's certainly history worth saving. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Follow along with us at historyworthsaving.com. And of course, you can sign up for our newsletter if you'd like to do so, where you can never miss an episode. Again, my thanks to Ian Quasar and my thanks to you. If you have a story idea, you can always send me an email right there at the website as well. So long for now, everyone.